John chapter 18. We are now heading into material that is absolutely crucial to the Christian faith. This is material that you need to know like the back of your hand. This is material that is foundation to what Christianity is all about. The Gospels were written because there came a point when people said, what actually happened to this guy named Jesus? I thought he was the Messiah. What happened? I don't understand. I heard he died. The Gospels were written in two responses just like that to help them understand exactly who he was, the results, the scenario around his death, and then his subsequent resurrection. So that's why these are all important. All four Gospels record some sort of activities in the Garden of Gethsemane, trials, punishments, crucifixions, and resurrections. All four, because all four have to deal with the main topic of Christianity, and that's what it is. As we go through John 18, I'm going to try and step through a little bit of a minefield, because John is very different from all the other gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He writes different material. He locates the material in the same place. Like, we're going to have a Garden of Gethsemane scene, and we're going to have a betrayal by Judas, but it's going to sound vastly different than all the stories maybe you know. And that's because John already knows that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are being circulated around the churches, and so they already have the basic information. So John gives his story from his point of view and adds details to help us understand. I could go into one of two extremes. I could go to try and harmonize everything and pull in every single tidbit from Matthew, Mark, and Luke to recreate the entire story, but then you're going to miss John's point of view. Or I could just give you John's point of view and not bring out any other detail, and you go like, this isn't the gospel story I remember. That's because it's different material. So I'm going to try and tread lightly. I'm going to bring in material here and there that will help supplement the account, but never ever forget, John is writing for a very specific purpose, and that is to show that God is always in control. Jesus has always been in control, that his time was not something that was forced on him, the death was no accident, the betrayal did not surprise him, everything happened exactly the way he said it was going to happen. He is always in control. I will also tell you right now that we will get through John chapter 18, and we are going to end at verse 27. We will not get, and there's a reason for that. Chapter 19 is an unfortunate chapter division. I don't think that's a good place to put it, because what we're going to see here is different experiences of Christ, people having different points of view about who he is. We're going to see Pilate's point of view, Peter's point of view. We're even going to notice something weird about this guy named Malchus and what his point of view was. We're going to have Annas and Caiaphas. Everyone has different reactions to who this guy is. And that's why it's kind of an unfortunate chapter division, because that really belongs to... If I was going to do it, I'd put chapter 19 starting at verse 16. That would be a much better place to put it, because all the stuff leading up to that is going to be up to his crucifixion, and chapter 19, verse 16 starts the crucifixion. So that's what we're going to be doing today. Let's pray. Father, as we read your word, we come at it with a sense of awe, as we know this is holy material that we are about to embark on. I pray, Lord, that we don't get distracted by the details. We understand the details so that the story comes alive to us. But let us never forget that all of this had to happen so that we could be with you, and that we could be in your grace and in your love. And we marvel once again that greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends, which is exactly what Jesus did. Help us as we read. Amen. John 18. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. We've left the temple now. Again, it's not clear exactly where chapters 14, 15, and 16, and 17 happen. I believe some of it happened in the upper room, and then I believe the rest of it happened at the temple. They leave the temple, and they now are going to go and cross into the garden that's called Gethsemane. And they cross what's called the Kidron Valley. Valley's kind of a weird word. Probably, this won't sound right, but it'd be a wadi. If you know what a wadi is something that, for the most part, stays as a dry creek bed. But when the rains come, it's a torrential thing. That's what they cross. They cross this Kidron Valley. Now, it doesn't say that it's raining, but I can tell you something. The river is flowing, but it's not flowing with water. It's flowing with blood. Because the Kidron Valley was the runoff from where the sacrificial lambs of Passover, all of the blood that would happen from that, would then be streamed down the Kidron, which is kind of an eerie sight if you think about it, as Jesus is crossing over this, essentially it's a river of blood. And it's the Passover lamb's blood. It's very, you know, evokes a lot of images. Very, very interesting. And if we take Josephus' account, which is kind of inflated, I think, but I can't tell. He said something is like 200,000 lambs were killed at this particular Passover. That's a lot of, I mean, if you count it up, that means there's millions of people in the city, and it really couldn't hold all that. So I don't know if it's an inflated amount. All I do know is that every able-bodied Jew had to come for Passover, and you had to kill a lamb, and you had to celebrate this feast. So lots of lambs killed. This river is flowing, and he is now going to this olive grove. We don't know who owns the olive grove. We don't know who owns the Garden of Gethsemane. It was private property, but apparently that's where he went. So whoever owned it was obviously sympathetic to Christ in his cause. Maybe it was Joseph of Arimathea. Maybe it was Nicodemus. We know that he was second or top wealthiest man back in that day, very wealthy man. Maybe he owned it. But apparently that's one of his base of operations. He wasn't allowed to go all the way down to Bethany, though it was a short hike away. He had to remain within the confines of Jerusalem according to the Passover rules. So he is there in this garden of Gethsemane, and he went there often. That's what verse 3 says. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Now, how many were there? We're not sure. The word could be, a detachment of soldiers could be anywhere up to 600 people and their commander. Now, I don't think all 600 showed up. That would be like if, you know, a rebellion breaks out in the city of Orange and the dispatcher sends all of Orange PD to the one location. That would be a little bit of overkill. But we do know that Pilate and these people have already talked. Pilate was the one in charge of this garrison, so he would have had to have given the order to go and take care of the situation. They know it's a rebellion. They know it's Jesus and at least 11 others. There might be more because a week earlier, there was this big parade and everyone got all riled up singing Hosanna, Hosanna to the Son of David. So I'm sure they sent over a good number of soldiers. My guess would be probably around 200 soldiers and the captains with them. Along with that group is going to be the temple guard. The temple had their own group of people, their own soldiers to help protect the things of the temple and the priests. So all of these are being guided and led by this man named Judas. Big group coming. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, I just chuckle at words like that. Oh, Jesus knew about this. Well, that's good. Again, that's the theme of John. God is in control. Knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, who is it that you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. I am he, Jesus said, and Judas the betrayer was standing there with him. When Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, he asked them, who is it that you want? And they told, and they said, I think probably a little more cautiously this time, Jesus of Nazareth. I told you that I am he, Jesus answered. If you're looking for me, then let these men go. This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. Is that the story you remember? What's obviously missing from the story? The kiss. Where's the betrayal by the kiss? I thought that Judas came up to him and to help guide which one was the traitor, he goes up and gives him the kiss, and that's how they figure it out. But in this account, it appears that Jesus steps forward. Jesus takes the initiative. He steps forward and says, who are you looking for? Jesus Nazareth. That's me. And then they all felt... These things can be harmonized, but I'm confident that John left out the kiss because it almost paints the picture as if Jesus is being set up. But was Jesus set up? Did Jesus know what was going on? John, instead of focusing on the kiss, focuses on the fact that God is in control. And I believe both events happened. Where the kiss happened and when did this happen on that night, how they interplay, I don't know. You could easily reconstruct something that can put both of the events in there. But John is focusing on this, on Jesus going out. He's the one. He steps forward and says, what is it that you want? And I love it. They say Jesus of Nazareth, and he says this phrase, I am he, which is kind of misleading. You could probably take one guess of the original Greek that he says, ego a me, I am. Not I am he, I am. He gives a statement of who he is, not only son of man, but son of God. And when he says this, they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, everyone has these different ideas of exactly what took place there. Was it that Jesus was so charismatic that when he, you know, stepped forward and said, I am he, they were shocked that he would turn himself in so quickly, and they kind of stumble back, and then like dominoes, a bunch of them fall over? I read that, and I'm like, that doesn't quite sound right. So I went back and I said, this phrase of falling down to the ground, this concept of being, encountering what I believe is when you encounter God and you fall down to the ground, does that happen anywhere else in Scripture? Yes, it does. Well, where does it happen? Well, I'm really glad you asked that question. Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 28, Ezekiel's writing this vision, like the appearance, and he's describing God, and he was like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. When I saw it, I fell face down and heard the voice of one speaking. Seems to be a typical response when encountering God's glory, they fall to the ground. Daniel chapter 10, then I heard him speaking, and as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. And some people are like, oh, God is so peaceful and soothing, and he causes you to fall asleep. No, the idea behind falling into a deep sleep, that would be a euphemism, like it scared him so much he fell down dead. Because look at the next phrase, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. Paul, when he describes his Damascus conversion, three times it shows up. The actual event, and then two other times, he fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Then in Acts 22, he's describing it. He says, I fell to the ground and heard a voice say to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And then a little bit later on in Acts 26, he says, well, not only me, but also everyone with me fell down to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. So Saul has the exact same experience of encounter. I believe that for a brief moment, God let it out. God turned it on, and it just, they saw for just a glimpse that they were dealing with no ordinary man. My opinion, I can't back it up except for the fact that he speaks, they fall down, and the only other time that happens is when God's glory is being revealed. So to me, it makes sense that he just, you know, see, because that's what I would have done. I would have gone, Dad! Ah! And then they would have all gotten back up, and they're like, did you all see that? I don't know. Did something happen to us? Who are you looking for? Jesus of Nazareth? Yeah, I don't know. That's how I see it. That's how I see it. And then he gives this wonderful statement there in verse 8. If you're looking for me, then let these men go. And this happened so that the words you had spoken would be fulfilled. I've not lost one of those you gave me. It also ties back into John chapter 10 when he's talking about the good shepherd. The hired man is not the shepherd who owns the sheep, so when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. He's fulfilling a direct thing. He's saying, look, I'm going to lay down my life. Not just I'm going to lay down my life on the cross for sin and salvation and humankind and all my disciples, but he also literally fulfilled it when he said, I don't want any of these people taken in. Now, should all of them have been taken in? It was an insurrection. You don't just take in the leader, right? In our war in Iraq, right, we're not just going after, you know, we weren't just going after Saddam. We had 51 other cards, right? We had a lot of other people. We're going at, that's what's happening here. They didn't come just to get Jesus. They want the whole group. But somehow or other, all of them are left. All of them are left alone. Very interesting. Again, how God fulfills what he says is going to happen. And Simon Peter. Dun, dun, dun! Gotta love Peter. I am so Peter. I am so Peter. Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" And that's in reference to his suffering. John is the only one that records his name. Why would he record his name? You know what Malchus means? My king. Oh, that's interesting. As he tries to tie in this idea of Jesus being king, you're going to see it through the crucifixion as they're all giving mock praise to their king. John's putting a huge sense of irony on the whole thing, that they really are actually killing the king. Very ironic. So he's the only one that records that his name is Malchus. He doesn't report that it was healed. If you were a gospel writer, which gospel writer would do that? Luke, because he was a physician. He'd be interested in the fact that, I don't know how, again, the idea that his ear got sliced off, the sword that is described as a short sword, it wasn't designed for cutting. Like, you know, if I was going to come at you, I wouldn't like try and chop off your arm. It was really thick, and the idea was it was a skull splitter. So that if you come at me, I would come just straight down on you, split your skull open, and you'd die. It wasn't, you know, meant to slit your throat. So you could imagine when Peter comes wildly swinging, he missed the head, but not by much. And, well, he is a fisherman. We got to give him a little bit of break. He's just grabbing the sword, and he wields it down. And I don't know, did Malchus just move or what? Did he just kind of, you know, out of the way? And down it chopped, and it probably injured other things. So when it was cut off, it wasn't like it was this clean surgical cut. It was probably cut slash ripped slash torn off. What would be the penalty for Peter for cutting off the high priest's ear or servant? Death! Jesus! Death! It's one of those answers. Death is the right thing. You cut off the servant, the ear of the servant of the high priest, you're dead. Which tells us why not only did Jesus heal this man because he's good and he's gracious and loving, but I think he was saving Peter's life. Because at that moment, they could have killed him. But you're healed. You don't have, you know. He cut off my ear!
Where's the evidence?
What? Yes, Mike. You know what? There's lots of things about Malchus that we don't know. Now, I know that there's a lot of people that get injured by Christians. Like Malchus. A lot of people get hurt by what Christians say and what Christians do. And I can't tell you the right times to wield your sword and the right times to put your sword away, because that calls for wisdom in individual circumstances. But there are times when it is appropriate to wield the sword. If I was preaching on Ephesians chapter 6 and the armor of God and got to the sword, I would say, come on, get your swords out, let's use them. And then I get to John chapter 18 and I'm like, put your swords away, don't be so high. Well, which one is it? I think Christians are confused. I know I'm confused half the time. When's the appropriate time? When should I do it? When should I speak out? When should I not? And that's when wisdom happens. But it is such a good thing that Malchus gets healed from the wounding of a Christian. There might be evidence that shows that Malchus becomes friendly. Malchus, I believe, tells people. Now, later on we're going to find out that one of the people that questions Peter is a relative of Malchus. How did the relative of Malchus find out about this whole incident? Okay, someone might have gone to him and said, hey, dude, did you hear what happened to Malchus? Or was it Malchus himself that went and said something? I don't know. But unfortunately, a lot of people get injured by Christianity, and because of that, they say, I'm going to write the whole thing off. And if that's you, I invite you to be healed by the Master and listen to what he has to say. And also take a look at the other Christians. Do you know that Peter was not the only one who had a sword? There was another disciple there that had a sword. I can't tell you which one, but in Luke, Jesus is prepping him for a fight. This happens in the Garden of Gethsemane. The Last Supper, they're getting ready to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And he's all, remember how before I told you, you know, don't worry about your provisions, people will take care of you, people will be friendly to your message? Well, guess what? Sell your cloak, sell your hat, sell your purse, buy a sword. And the message in that was, get ready for a fight. Now the disciples, buy a sword, buy a sword, buy a sword. Hey, look, Lord, there's two swords. And Jesus kind of hustles, oh gosh, that's enough, thanks. And they go off their way. There was two swords there. So I invite people again, not all Christians are wild, swinging swordsmen. There's people that are refraining. There's people that are doing it. And again, I always get nervous when I hear people talking about the stories of how they got hurt by a Christian, and it tears me apart. But don't just let that one spoil it. Don't let that one keep you from the kingdom. There's others that are not wielding their swords this way. At this point, we know from other Gospels, after he does get arrested, the disciples scatter. Everyone runs. We know two disciples follow. We know that Mark is present. He's not a disciple. He's just a little kid. But he ends up getting grabbed by a Roman soldier, and he takes off and runs naked. That's in Mark. Yeah, it sounds like Mark Thomas, yeah. Just get him wet, and he'll just get naked for you. Everyone scatters. Then the detachment of soldiers, with its commanders, and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it'd be good if one man died for the people. Now, this is where we're going to get... I want to make sure you understand this a little bit later on. There's a question of who's doing the interrogation. Is it the high priest Caiaphas or the high priest Annas? Wait, I thought there was only one high priest, right? Yeah, there is only one high priest. The reigning high priest at that point was the guy named Caiaphas. He was the official high priest of that time. Annas was a high priest at one time, from AD 6 to AD 14. And he was deposed by the Romans. They didn't like him, but that wouldn't sit very well with Jewish people. You just can't take away their supreme ruler in this whole thing. But Annas isn't one that just goes quietly in that good night. He becomes something akin to a mobster. He ends up somehow with his political influences. Not only does he remain in power and people still address him as high priest, but he also gets five other high priests elected that are his sons, and then one of his son-in-laws, Caiaphas. Caiaphas is a son-in-law. So he's kind of the power behind the power. And also later on, John right here calls Annas the high priest. Is there any problem with that? No. If Jimmy Carter walked in this room, you would all fall flat on your face going, oh my God, no. If Jimmy Carter came into this room, how would you address him? Mr. President, President Jimmy Carter. When Ronald Reagan died at his funeral, was at the funeral? President Ronald Reagan, were they really the president? No, they were former presidents, but they still received that title and that due. A lot of people get all confused and they want to explain, well, it was Annas was there, but no, Caiaphas was there because he was the high priest and John got his things wrong. No, John didn't get it right. Annas was the high priest. He was a previous high priest, and he was the one that was still in power. He was the one getting everyone elected as high priest. And Caiaphas, his son-in-law, was the official high priest, but he's first brought to Annas. We're going to find out there's six trials, six meetings that Jesus has to go to. He goes to Annas first, he goes to Caiaphas, he goes to the trial before the Sanhedrin. After that, he goes to Pilate. Pilate finds out he's a Galilean, sends him off to Herod, Tetrarch of Galilee. Herod wants him to do a couple little tricks. Jesus doesn't oblige, gets bored with him, sends it off to Pilate and says, oh, too bad, I don't care where he's born. He's your problem now. And Pilate then finally finishes it up. We piece that together from all of the different accounts, but we're not going to see all of those accounts. John's only going to focus on a little bit. And he's going to do this in contrast with Peter and what happens with him. So chapter 18, verse 15. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Who is the other disciple? That's a good guess. I think that's right. But others have been purported to, you know, others have been put forth as possible candidates as this other disciple. The big question is, we find out this other disciple has ties into the high priest. Would John have ties into the high priest? John was a fisherman. Would he really have ties to the high priest? I think he can, because he was part and parcel of a huge operation, the sons of Zebedee, and they had servants. And so they could be very powerful and wealthy, and John could have that in. That's why some people have set forth Joseph of Arimathea as the other disciple. Some have said it's Nicodemus. But John has no hesitation elsewhere in the gospel naming these people. So one commentator, very interesting, I sat on it for just a while and contemplated it, but it's ludicrous. Someone suggested it was Judas. That's interesting. Wouldn't it? Would Judas have have access to the high priest? Oh, yeah. He got access now. Yeah. I don't think it's him, because I think John would have said, and Judas, the scum-sucking disciple, was the one who did it. He does it all over the place. He's all, if you notice the subtlety, you know, John says, and Judas was with them. He's very specific on that thing. So I think this is John. No question about it. Well, there's a question about it, but that's what I think. Simon Peter and other disciples were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside of the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. You're not one of his disciples, are you? The girl at the door asked Peter. He replied, nope. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had to make to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. There's a lot of subtleties that are going on here that I need to make sure that you bring out. Don't get it in your mind's eye of Peter's denial situation. It's been prophesied he's going to deny three times before the rooster crows. I do not think it happened like this. Hey, aren't you one of his disciples? Nope. Oh, I think you're one of his disciples. Nope. Are you sure you're not one of his disciples? Nope. I don't think it happened like that. I don't think it happened that way. In fact, I'm confident because Luke tells us that between denial number 2 and 3, there was a full hour. A full hour took place. I think that these things happen so spread apart that the subtlety that Satan uses to tempting us is amazing. And he starts off simply. This girl standing at the door. It's a simple question. Also, English tried to pick up on it, but the Greek is very specific. It's anticipating a negative response. We kind of do it with the inflection of our voice, right? You see the, you know, kid doing something wrong. You're like, you're not doing something wrong, are you? And it's anticipating, yes, I am. And we try and do the inflection so that it anticipates a negative response. This, the actual words are used. So, you weren't with them, were you? Type of thing. Makes it very easy to say, no idea what you're talking about. Again, he was wielding a sword in the garden just a little while ago. That's how Satan works, taking the most bold and zealous man. He knows that if Satan comes at him with everything he's got, Peter's going to grab the nearest sword and start hacking away. Satan knows, I can't get him that way. I'm going to go subtle. You were with him, were you? No. Very simple. And then left it alone and stopped. And I think some time took place. John is insinuating it because he breaks from the story. And he doesn't. He starts off with Peter saying just one denial, and then he goes back into this interrogation with Jesus. I tell you, John must have been a filmmaker, because this would have played out perfectly on film. Perfectly. The subtleties, I'm going to talk more on that. The subtleties of Satan. But let's get back to the text, verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioning Jesus about his disciples, or the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews came together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. It's hard to, if you have to know Jewish law to figure out what is Jesus saying right there. All he's asking for is a fair trial. That's all he's simply saying. It was illegal for you to be questioned directly by the high priest. Back then, the Fifth Amendment was invoked for you automatically. You weren't even supposed to be addressed during the trial. They were just supposed to investigate, find out the story, and then pronounce guilty or innocent. And you'll find that all through this, every law is broken when it comes to this trial. They're not supposed to be questioning him. They're supposed to be calling witnesses. So Jesus says, just call some witnesses. They'll testify, I have no secret rebellion going on here. Verse 22, when Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. We don't know with what. Was it his hand? Was it a fist? Was it a rod? The same phrase can be used by hitting someone with a rod. If it was with a rod, it would be then direct fulfillment of Micah chapter 5, verse 1. Marshal your troops, O city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. This happens right before Micah 5:2. It's all tied in with Jesus because, I don't have Micah 5:2 up there. But good anticipation. But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, are by no means least among the tribes of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler from olden days. Direct prophecy thing. And I think Micah 5:1-2. So hit him. Do you think that was legal? No. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what I did wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? He's saying, this is illegal. You just broke the law. They don't care. They're not interested in the law. Then Annas sent him still bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. The text note tries to explain that it was Caiaphas all along given the interrogation, but it's not NIV. Is correct there. Annas sends him to Caiaphas. We have no record in John of the discussion of Caiaphas with Jesus because John doesn't need to pick it up. It's already been explained in other Gospels. He knows other people have read it. He's filling in other details. So Peter then does something else. As Simon Peter stood warming himself, he was asked, you're not one of his disciples, are you? Same thing, anticipating a negative response. He denied it, saying, I am not. It doesn't come through very well in the English. A lot of people have a problem with the second inquisitor. One of the gospel readers said it was a young girl. Another gospel reader said it was a male. Well, which one was it? Male or female? That's a pretty crucial detail, don't you think? John clears it up. The phrase there, he was asked, tries to capture but doesn't do it very well. It's plural. Several people asked him, aren't you one of them? So was it a young girl? Mm-hmm. Was it a man? Mm-hmm. A bunch of people. And again, I think if Satan would have come out with this one right at the beginning, I think Peter would have succeeded. I think if a bunch of people came up to him and said, hey, aren't you it? Aren't you it? And they pressed in on him like that, I think he would have fought the good fight. I think he would have said, yeah, I'm one of them and I'll take anyone on that dares cross me. I think he would have. But when you cross one line, it's so easy to cross the next. And that's how Satan works. Take an affair, for example. If someone comes into a guy's office, strips naked and says, have sex with me, it's a little bit easier to go, stop, right? But that's not how affairs happen, is it? No, it starts off very subtly. It's a small line you cross, and it's probably not even a big line. I think one of the movies that captured this brilliantly, though Rich Manning hates this movie, is Swim Fan. There is this one scene in Swim Fan and I wish I would have brought it, because it was a perfect thing. He's got a girlfriend, and then Psycho Hose Beast is, you know, hitting on him, and Psycho Hose Beast, he ends up with a purse or a book or something that, you know, after an introduction, left her purse behind. So he's going to go take the purse back to the girl's house, and it's very fast. It's very fast. As he's getting ready to leave, his mom says a statement, which is very telling. Did you change your clothes? And right there I said, that's exactly how it starts. I mean, why did he change his clothes? Why is he looking a little nicer? Is there anything wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with... No, there's no sin in that whatsoever, but you can see it's one little line, just a small line. And you cross that one. It's like he's dropping these Reese's Pieces out to see if he can get E.T. to come out. That's exactly how to just one at a time. If I pick up the one, am I going to pick up? M&M's was dumb, weren't they? I'm going to pick up Reese's Pieces are better anyway. And just slowly and surely it draws it. That's exact. Don't think that Satan's going to come at you wholeheartedly because it is too easy to resist. He's going to make you cross lines you never intended to cross in the first place. That's how he works. Because now an hour takes place right here. An hour between 25 and 26. And I didn't put it up on PowerPoint. I'm really sorry. If you want that reference, it's Luke 22, verse 59. You can read it. It says specifically an hour took place. And right then, you know what? I know what Peter's saying. Peter had a full hour to justify his actions. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I didn't do anything wrong. No, it's no big deal. It's good to get in here. I need to be closer to Jesus. I didn't deny him in front of the world. If they would have stopped me at the door, I couldn't be there with them. It's not that big. I'm sure this stuff is just reeling in his mind. But he's already crossed the line once, and he's already crossed the line twice. And that's why then one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. It's a fight. Now, how did this guy know? Did Malchus come and tell it? Maybe just through the grapevine? I don't know. Did Malchus become a believer after that? I don't know. But this guy finds out, and he says, "Didn't I see you with him in the olive grove?" Again, Peter denied it, and at that moment, a rooster began to crow. A couple quick things. Some people get all hung up. One gospel writer says, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. And then others say, before the rooster crows three times, you'll deny me. And well, how many times was it? Did the rooster crow once or twice? Has anyone here ever heard a rooster crow once? Yeah, does it all morning long. That's what I think John is trying to pick up here. It says it began to crow. From another gospel writer, I believe it's Luke, Jesus is being led out of the house at that very exact moment and turns and looks at Peter. Tradition had it that after this incident, even though in John chapter 21 he was reinstated and got a chance to confess his love for Christ, everywhere he went, every time he preached, he was heckled. Someone would sit in the crowd. They'd meet him on the roadway. That makes the book of Acts that much more amazing. Here we see someone that is totally bold and zealous for Christ, and apparently in all the good ways. But I believe he was harassed endlessly. He was constantly reminded of his sin, but he still did it. A couple things to get from that. First of all, don't think you're invincible. The moment you think you couldn't do anything like Peter is the moment it's about to happen. Peter was the one, if you would have taken a poll, a Gallup poll of the 11 disciples, the last disciple that they would have ever thought to pull that off was Peter. That's why Jesus tells him that, so he doesn't fall too far. Peter was the last person that anyone would have ever guessed this would have happened to. Don't think, we are all just a step away from big trouble. Always being diligent and never crossing that first line is key. Also, if you have crossed the line and you think you are without hope, you need to go today and read John 21. And that's when Jesus brings Peter back into the fold. And Peter never lets his sin get in the way of ministry. I don't think he ever denied that it happened. I don't think he ever tried to shirk the responsibility. But he never said to him, "I'm not going to let my past sins keep me from doing the ministry that I need to do." And he boldly and courageously did that. And this is where we're going to stop. Next week, we're going to take Jesus before Pilate, the second half of chapter 18 to the first half of John 19. And again, don't miss sight. I'm bringing in, I'm bringing in a lot of details from other places to help us understand the full picture. Never miss sight of the fact there's a reason why he died. And that was you. And that was me. He died so that we would not be lost. He died so none of us could be taken from his hand. He died because he wanted to take our place. All of those, he died because of his great love. Greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. Let's pray. Lord, as we read this stuff, we are in awe that you would do such great sacrifice. And I know we're looking at details, and I know that for some of us, I know for me it helps because the details help me get kind of detached from the emotional stress of what's going to take place. But I pray that these details never distract, that what Jesus went through was absolutely horrendous and some of the worst things ever to happen to any human being. And I'm amazed that he would do that for someone like me. Someone who is so easily like Peter. He did it for Peter. He died for Peter, even though that he was denied by him. I pray, Lord, that you would guard our steps, that you would help us to see that we are just one step away. Satan is constantly asking to take us. He constantly wants to separate us, but you won't let him. And I pray that we would guard our steps and not even cross any boundary that would remotely get us into trouble. And help us confess the good faith. Help us to fight that good fight. Help us to be bold in our proclamation, but not damaging to other people. And over all that, Lord, give us the wisdom and the humility to know when that should happen. We praise you for what Christ did in his will. Amen.